Disclaimer. The views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. The show tapes live some weeks on Thursdays at 5 p.m. Pacific Time. Check my Twitter feed, ANNZAC, for more. Enjoy the show. Everybody, welcome to Ancast. I'm Zach Burchie. Jacob's here.
Hey, folks.
And we're joined by Anime News Network's prolific and very intelligent managing interest editor. Thanks for coming on the show, Lindsay. Lindsay Lee Loveridge is here.
Hi, everybody.
Okay, so I hate to say this, but we're pushing our Gankutsuo discussion out one more week.
Hey, hey.
No. So we're finally going to discuss the show, Gankutsuo, The Count of Monte Cristo, produced by Gonzo Animation, the infamous Gonzo Animation.
Days, yes. 2004.
Yeah, just about 12, 13 years ago now. Makes you feel a little old. We usually start these discussions by talking about how we came to the show first. And Jacob, why don't you start out here?
For me, the answer is a little bit funny because I came to the show when I was really into reading Anime News Network as a teenager, and it was one of the most recommended shows of the year by you. And I read your review.
By me?
Yeah, and I purchased it after all six volumes were out in 2006.
Did I review, like, the first volume or something?
Yeah, and then there were, like, other articles that were, like, best of the year and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You mentioned that it was good. In Answer Man, I think you mentioned it a couple times, too. But, like, that was a long time ago. But I bought it and watched all of it in 2006 or so. So, and I loved it and rewatched it several times over the next 2 years. But I have now not seen it for 10 years. But I had it almost memorized because I rewatched it over and over when I was 16, 17, 18. So,
right. Okay.
That was my experience with it. Was I just like, oh, somebody that ANN says it's good. This guy seems to have good opinions. Bought it all on DVD and watched it insanely much. I was also drawn to it because Count of Monte Cristo was one of my favorite books. But I had a lot of favorite books as a child. So as a teenager, when I stopped reading basically at age 15 or 16 and started watching stuff instead. So it was basically just taking my old. My old favorite pastime and turning it into a new one. Instead of reading The Count of Monte Cristo, I was watching an anime of it. So.
Right. Yeah. I do have good opinions.
That was pretty cute.
Well, now.
Lindsay, what about you?
Okay, so the first time I watched Count of Monte Cristo was approximately 5 years ago, and it was right after Zach hired me to write the list column.
So connected.
I had written... maybe two or three before I wrote a most visually interesting anime series or something like that. It was really early into my writing the column.
It sounds
and the
like
Count of Monte Cristo wasn't on it, and people were so I got a bunch of comments in the forum for that. You know, where's the Count of Monte Cristo? Why didn't you put the Count of Monte Cristo on there? And I had never seen it, so I bought it during a Write Stuff sale. Might have been around Christmas time, and just bought the whole series on DVD and watched all of it.
Wait a second, hang on a second. Now I gotta stop you right there.
Okay.
Because you just mentioned that you bought this show. Not only did I hire you right before you had a run in with this show, but you also mentioned the Right Stuff holiday sale, which, interestingly, I was going to bring up anyway, just apropos of nothing. Can you believe that?
Right.
Wow.
I mean, not to derail this conversation or take away from what you were saying, but the Right Stuff holiday sale is happening right now, and there's over 2,900 items on sale. Can you believe that? One of them might be Gankutsuo. You could go back and get Gankutsuo all over again.
Yep.
Did you know
I don't know if those Genion discs are still there, probably not.
Jacob, did you know that there's porn available in the Right Stuff holiday sale?
Tell me more.
Yeah, it's called the Naughty List, and there's plenty of cheap pornography.
But is there Count of Monte Cristo pornography?
No, probably not. But if you head over to the Right Stuff holiday sale right now, everyone who buys something gets entered into a contest to win a $250 gift card. It's pretty incredible. Mm-hmm. Head on over to rightstuffanime.com. Holiday sale right now. Don't miss it. Anyway, I can't believe that, Lindsay. What a coincidence. initially, what was your take on it?
I loved it the first time through. I thought it was great. I liked, the plot was more intricate than what I was used to seeing from anime at the time, as far as all the different players interacting with each other. So, but I didn't revisit it. But that's just kind of notorious of me. I tend to be a one and done person. So this was my first time revisiting it in about 5 years.
Mm-hmm. All right. It was big and hyped up when it came out. Gonzo was hot at the time. I've been doing this job for an extremely long time. And so anything that came out in the last 17 years, the way I came to it was, I work with anime, so of course I knew about the show and watched it. I never finished it, though. I never finished it back then. I got about halfway through it. The first half of the show was very familiar to me. The last half was not. I don't think I ever watched the very end. I don't think I ever watched the final DVD. I think that's what it was.
Right.
And the thing is that, like, if you watched anime, like, if you bought anime back then, and that's how you watch stuff, was on those single discs. Mm-hmm. If you missed one, or just gave up on buying it, or the middle was bad, that would happen. Like, so there are shows in my memory where I have seen the first two-thirds of it, but I never saw the last part, because I lost interest before the last disc came out, or whatever. This is one of those shows.
Yeah, that was... I owned, for the longest time... When I say for the longest time, I mean... before 4, 5, and 6 were all out. I think it was like only 4 was out or something like that. I owned just the first 3 volumes, so I saw the first half of Gunkutsu over and over, and I ended on... I forget what the cliffhanger is off the end of Disc 3. It's something, but I saw it... Oh, the Count is about to be arrested by Prosecutor Villefort.
Oh, jeez.
And that was... I think I watched that over and over, because I didn't have any other option. I didn't have the next 3. But yeah, like that individual discs back then, it was a time.
And it gets brought up a lot in terms of, like, this show was really visually daring, and they did something that,
overambitious.
And definitely. Extremely ambitious. People brought that up a lot, but otherwise, most people just, it was also a really good show. It's also a good adaptation of The Count of Monte Cristo. Mm-hmm. But I never got to the end of it. So, I just now saw the end, for the first time.
Oh.
I'd never watched the ending before. And that is my experience with and obviously I reviewed the first DVD. I should go back and I'm sure that review is hyperbolic to a bizarre extreme, talking about how great the show is, but
I'm sure.
But, I'll go back and look at it. Read my review of the last disc of Razafan for some hyperbole about it. Yeah. Everyone has some failings as a writer.
It's all right.
You are the person who's most familiar. Neither Lindsay nor I have read the book,
right?
Which is a giant, thick serial from the 1800s.
Yeah, it was published in 1844. I want to say 1844, and it ran for 2 years, and it was like the Game of Thrones of its time. It was the biggest shit in the world.
Yeah.
Not in the world, in France, but also other... It got translated very quickly and then moved to other countries. People were like, you gotta read this.
It got fan-subbed and...
It was, yeah, exactly. It was like
people would download Monte Cristo Raws.
Yeah, it was... A lot of people talk about...
I'm learning French, so I don't have to wait. You should do the same thing.
Yeah. A lot of people... because a lot of people talk about, like, famous novels that are famous after the person dies, or, they're not really appreciating their time. Monte Cristo was an immediate success. And it makes sense because it starts with, it employs cliffhangers very frequently. And there were some serialized adventures that were, at the time, that were like, it was an ongoing thing. But like, you think of Sherlock Holmes, and it's like, they're individual things, and there is an ongoing continuity to it, to Moriarty and to, to all the other ongoing characters that would get entangled in Sherlock's life. But it didn't have that immediate, like, something terrible is brewing, and you're going to see what it is. And it, like, the fact that it was called The Count of Monte Cristo, and there was no count. It was just about this ordinary sailor yeah, this ordinary sailor who worked on the docks, and, like, it's kind of the kind of like Monte Cristo in the first chapter, ended with, like, him being, like, stalked by his, by the ship's clerk, who was, like, resentful of him, and, like, you know, biting his lip enough to draw blood or something like that. It was just very evocative. And so immediately the novel was a huge success. And so it was, yeah, it was serialized in a magazine. So it was like the TV of the day. You couldn't buy it as a book for several years until it was done. And, you know, it was very, you know, and to this day it has persisted. Like, it's not one of those things that's like, people don't know the plot of it like the back of their hand, like a lot of classic, not a lot of classic, but some classic literature like Jungle Book or whatever, where you could say like what happens in it and everything. A lot of the stuff that was immortalized by Disney, I guess, but like it's
pretty much only by Disney.
Yeah, it stayed in the cultural consciousness, sort of in the background, and it's been.
I mean, I feel like over the years there were rumors of a Disney Count of Monte Cristo that would have been.
I don't think that would have ever happened. It's a very
well. They went with Hunchback of Notre Dame instead. So.
Yeah. That would have been weird.
It would have been weird as hell. Yeah. But and it wouldn't have been as good like as this.
What do you want to call it? Wasn't that Revenge Show and there was like an 8 in the logo? Wasn't that a Monte Cristo adaptation?
There have been a lot of them. There's a famous one.
Very few are straight adaptations. They're usually like a basic concept and we put it somewhere else.
And there's a famous one with Guy Pearce that came out.
Yeah, that's
that was like the most recent.
That's one the most well-known.
That actually got like a marketing push and everything like that. But I feel like there are adaptations of this like every couple of years, and you might just not.
I feel like the Revenge one was like a CW TV series.
Yeah.
A couple of years.
They're all like in formats people don't care about. The only one that was like in a format that people cared about was the guy Pearce and Jim Caviezel movie. And then
Jim Caviezel.
Yeah, he was the other one.
Jesus himself.
It was prior to his stint as Jesus.
Yeah,
and
was it?
Yeah,
I thought that was like right after.
No, that movie came out in like 2002.
So that was like the movie before he became Jesus. Yeah.
Yes, before he became Christ.
Jim Caviezel is the star of The Passion of the Christ for people who are talking about.
The only like Jesus act. Yeah. I actually saw that in theaters on a date.
Me too. On a date? Someone took you on a date to see The Passion of the Christ.
Yeah.
Holy cow.
Yeah. Holy Christ.
Yeah.
Anyway, you can't see it, but Zach is crossing himself. Anyway, so I went on too long about that, but Count of Monte Cristo is a really, really big deal, and it was a really, really big deal in Japan, was my point. So it's not really a surprise that this was picked for a prestigious anime adaptation, because it's kind of been remembered in Japan like as much as France, maybe less so in America. But as this, like, timeless, like, oh, it's amazing, you know.
Right. And this was directed by Mihiro Maeda, who directed Blue Submarine No. 6. Mm-hmm. This, the best shorts from the Animatrix, which are the ones that the Revolution Parts 1 and 2, whatever that's, the Final Renaissance or whatever that is. I need to see that again. It's been a long time, but those were amazing. Like, those
the
shorts.
The one that sticks out in my head is the one that was about the marathon racer. I haven't seen it in a really long time either.
Yeah, but do you remember the ones that sort of told the story of the machine uprising?
Yes, okay. A little bit.
Yeah, those were kind of fucked up, but they were really, really good, and they were better than the Matrix sequels. Like, they were really good. He directed those, and then he directed this. And Maeda is like he's an aesthetic artist. Like, he's a visual artist, not really a story guy. So it makes sense that this is an adaptation of The Count of Monte Cristo.
Right. Well, most of his work, like, it's for as extremely talented as he is, like, most of his work is not series direction. It's like basically world building for other stuff. Like, he did a bunch of world building work for Escaflowne and Evangelion and stuff like that, and you don't really hear about it. And the last 10 years, he's just been working on Rebuild.
On Rebuild, yeah.
And
I've been a fan. I mean, I've been a big fan of his. Like, I don't really like the story of Blue Sub, but I did kind of like. I liked the color work in that thing. Mm-hmm. The color work.
Yeah, well, that those OVAs have very striking aesthetic. Like, it's, you know, very interesting world. It doesn't look like anything else, you know.
Yeah, and neither does Gankutsuo before or since.
Yeah, and he's a visual guy, and the script writers are just sort of a couple of different work. One was like a Gonzo, just did script adaptation for a bunch of Gonzo projects, and the other one's sort of a workhorse script writer. So I think for the most part, it's just a matter of Maeda's philosophical take on Count of Monte Cristo channeled through to, you know, competent and, like, very writers who just managed to turn out a really well-paced, really well-executed version of a story that was basically, like, a treasure trove for anybody. It's like, this story is incredibly rich, and you can take is incredibly rich and detailed, and it has a cast of thousands, so you can take kind of whatever elements you want and work it to your will.
Yeah,
and which is why it's it is surprising to me that more high profile adaptations of it have not been made, but whatever.
Yeah, well, the pacing, like, that's the thing while I was watching this. The thing that struck me about it is that it is paced and written and plotted like Game of Thrones or like Westworld, like purposefully hooky, grippy TV that is intentionally cliffhanger-y and pulls you into the next episode.
Yeah, it's all very super serial. You know, we talked about, like, other shows.
Okay.
I mean, I didn't mean like that. I didn't mean like a stupid joke reference.
All right.
But it's S-E-R-I.
I know what you mean.
But it's the only, like, comparable anime is, like, Escaflowne, I guess. But for most part, anime is not this, like, tightly written and pasted ends on a.
It's very easy to marathon it. Wait, what? Just to like the beginning just of sit through it and just keep going and going and going.
Yeah, it's just where it's just like cliffhanger into the next thing, into the next thing, into the next thing. So yeah, it was a big deal. It's very prestige project-y, but yeah.
So for people who don't know the story of the Count of Monte Cristo, we're not gonna sit here and summarize the Count of Monte Cristo because it's all plot. It's just plot. It's a serial, so you know, when you talk about this stuff, like we've had shows like this before where we didn't really want to just recount the plot because there's so much summary that has to happen.
Recount the plot?
Mm. Yep.
Anyway.
Recounting Monte Cristo?
Recounting Monte Cristo.
Anyway. Jacob knows this backwards and forwards, so he's going to run through. So run us through the Count of Monte Cristo, and then the major differences in Genkutsuo as stories.
Okay. As stories, just as a general overview, the Count of Monte Cristo took place in the early 1800s in France, the original novel. Obviously, this anime takes place in the year 5000-something in space.
It's very optimistic, by the way. That there will still be human beings behaving like human beings in the city of Paris 3,000 years from now.
With nobility. It's not really a view of the future, per se. It's a view of what if 1800s France took place in the year 5000.
In the year 5000.
It's kind of more of an excuse to throw some like technological hooks in there and have spaceships.
Yeah.
Same story, really. That's about it.
It's not intended to be predictive of one day society will be like this.
It's just for an aesthetic purpose. It's like taking the basic story and making it as like, you know, grandiose and sort of weird future-y as possible, but
still you look at it and they're just regular humans and you're like, the year 5000, huh?
Yeah,
that's really optimistic.
and they have upper class Parisian society,
and they're still going to operas and watching people play piano.
They go to operas. So it's interpretive, certainly, but
anyway, sorry.
Anyway, a story of Count of Monte Cristo is about a young man named Edmond Dantès who is a sailor, and he's very good man, and he's working hard to make enough money to marry his fiancée, who is a gorgeous Catalonian commoner woman named Mercedes, when he gets bushwhacked. He gets betrayed by three different people for their own reasons, for their own selfish reasons. One wants to steal his fiancée, one wants to steal his ship, and his financial opportunities that are coming up on him, and one is trying to protect his image. And because he's a very prominent judge, a man of the law, who's because Edmond gets betrayed by the other two, it puts this third guy in an awkward position where he's gonna have his name smeared unless he is complicit in this betrayal. So all three of them screw this poor guy over and send him to this horrible like Alcatraz like rock out in the middle of nowhere called the Chateau d'If. And he did nothing wrong, and so he spends like 12 years festering in anger over this, and decides to take revenge once he figures out that they betrayed him. And so the rest of the story is his revenge plot, where he comes back to he meets a presence in prison. Now the biggest difference between these two adaptations is that the presence he meets in prison kind of changes how you perceive the character, because in the original novel it's a benevolent force. It's a man named Abbe Faria who is a kindly old abbey. I forgot what they call it. Like he's a priest, basically. He's a kindly old priest, and he just so happened to have this amazing wealth of treasure that he hoarded away before he was, for political reasons, put away. And he tells him about this treasure. He tells him not to take revenge, and then he tells him about this treasure before he dies, and then he Edmond escapes and is able to use this treasure to come back to Paris as a noble and take his horrible revenge on these three men. And in the anime version, the Force is not a kindly old priest. It is an intergalactic demon named Gankutsuo, which is why the title
it's
is.
It's a demon of grief and revenge.
Yes, it is. Is an ages old demon who is residing in the body of another prisoner at the prison. And the thing about this prison is that it is actually a what they do with people in the year 5000 in space. If you're a really bad criminal, is they send you to a prison where you're shackled up to the wall and your life energy is sapped to you to fuel weapons of war, because there's an ongoing war with the Empire, with the space empire in this. And so the demon that he encounters is still hiding out in one of these bodies that is shackled to the wall and still being sapped of life energy like a zombie, just sort of unable to die. And so so he's been waiting for like another body to take, basically. And so where Edmond gets his endless wealth from is like just he gets possessed by a demon and kind of has endless powers. Like he can generate he has all this wealth that's been stored away by all the previous bodies that this demon has taken over, and now his body is vampire-like and immortal, and that, you know, all this stuff. It's more anime, you know. So this also makes him more evil. So the biggest difference between these two versions is that in the original story, the Count was sort of an anti-hero, a sympathetic, although doesn't always make the right choices, figure. And it is told from his perspective, and it's about him. In this version of the Count of Monte Cristo, he's sort of a villain. He's still sympathetic, but he's a bad guy mostly because of the whole demon instead of priest thing. And it's told from the perspective of one of his victims, which is the son of the man who stole his fiance. So, it's of course it's an anime, so it has to be told from teenagers' perspectives. So it's about this 15-year-old boy who is tricked by the Count and sort of watching this revenge happen from an innocent person's perspective.
Right, and through the course of the show, without like that's the basic rundown
right.
of the plot. There's a big cast, mm-hmm. and the Count's plot involves like a dozen people or so,
yeah,
all betraying and doing horrible things to each other, mm-hmm. counting on their worst instincts to enact his plan,
right?
That's pretty much the show.
Mm-hmm.
It ends fairly conventionally, for the most part. But
for the most part,
for the first half or so, I was like, I remember this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that there's, like, I kept thinking, because, you know, shows like Game of Thrones and everything have been ubiquitous since then, and now if a show is just plot, what I say to myself is, oh, this is just entertainment, like Westworld. Mm-hmm. Like, is this going to say something interesting and profound? It's just entertainment.
I disagree on Westworld.
It's just eventually it came around to say something interesting, yeah, mm-hmm. but I wouldn't say profound, but something interesting.
Yeah.
And this did, too, eventually. But for the first 12 or so episodes, I was kind of sitting there thinking, like, oh, this is very entertaining. It's incredibly well-paced and scripted and everything, but it's mostly just plot.
Mm-hmm.
And you said, like, yeah, the beginning's actually a little slow. Or at least it doesn't really get good until about halfway through.
I would say the beginning is the weakest part. I wouldn't say it doesn't get good. I would say it's good from the beginning, but it doesn't
comparatively,
really,
I guess.
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, you think about the original novel, and it's like immediately that this guy gets betrayed, and there's just all these high stakes. And in this version, you're just watching a 15-year-old kind of bratty, naive, dumb aristocrat mm-hmm. be a bratty, naive, dumb aristocrat without really knowing what's about to happen to him. So it doesn't have as strong of an opening. But, yeah.
Right. Well,
I think the turning point of it is probably about when they first go to his villa. That's when it really, I feel like,
right.
stops being so slow. Not his villa, because, I mean, the one that's in the woods,
ass.
The, like, lodge. Yeah, the cabin.
His Vegas basement.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I felt like, actually, there were a couple of turning points, like, places where I felt like the story really took a hard turn.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that helped with the pacing and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the first half of the show, That's pretty much where my head was at. And I remember I was discussing this with you, Jacob. I was like, I think this is all just plot. Is there anything to talk about? And you're like, yeah, there is.
Right, yeah.
And so I feel like we should kind of get to that in terms of what there is to discuss about The Count of Monte Cristo. And Jacob, you brought up a really interesting parallel or difference between this one and the original book in terms of what they're about. Mm-hmm. And can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, the thing I find really interesting about this as an adaptation is that The Count of Monte Cristo as a story, like I said, it's really detail-heavy. It's a bunch of interconnecting characters and plot points. And so usually you would think in an adaptation, well, okay, you maintain the spirit of the work, you maintain sort of the theme and the tone and what it was trying to say, but you change the plot willy-nilly as much as you want. This is a weird adaptation, and I think a very successful one in the opposite regard, where most of the plot points, except for shorting for brevity, most of the plot points and characters, even like little ones, are kept in the story. They keep like a large amount of the individual, like, here is exactly how this happens in this way. Like they say in space to all of that. Like,
yeah, right.
The addendum is in space, but other than that, it's the same. But the themes and the tone are completely different. The perspective is completely different because the original novel was written more about human nature. It was written more apart from harsh critique of the aristocracy, which is one thing they definitely have in common. It was more of just sort of an adventure type thing that was about like faith and human nature and forgiveness and like these sort of complex emotions of the heart. And it was from a Christian perspective. Alexandre Dumas was, you know, religious, and so that was how he saw the world, and that's how he navigated it. The anime is extremely secular liberal. Like, it's very liberal. I would say there's a lot of remarkably progressive things about it, certainly on an LGBT perspective. I don't know if we'll get into that, but the show has a lot of... It has at least three gay characters that aren't portrayed in any negative way at all whatsoever, which is interesting.
Or shouldn't say, or anything, really.
Yeah, I shouldn't say gay. Albert is bi, I would say. But, you know, like, left of straight, certainly. And,
hang on, now, I didn't detect any gayness between the Count and Albert at all.
Not the kiss?
No,
the
that's...
smooch on the face?
They're just friends.
The smooch that literally breaks the curse of his vengeance?
I'm gonna go post about this in the forums.
Right. Literally kisses his face. Breaks
Sorry,
the curse
go
of vengeance, which makes
Yeah,
me
no,
laugh.
It is. I think that stuff is pretty background. It's, mm-hmm. it's really background. It's
well,
really background.
There's a lot. Yeah, I was...
There's
I was
plenty of it, but
tangent.
There's a lot of background.
Yeah, I was mentioning it as a tangent. Mind you, but it was my point is this is a very secular view of the world. This is very politically driven. Like, the show's themes are very political. They are very
God actually doesn't factor into this at all.
God does not factor into it.
It's not a presence in the world.
No,
maybe that's one of the reasons I found it all so cynical, is that there wasn't any presence. There wasn't even spirituality to fall
there's
back
no
on
spirituality presence
it's to just, fall back on.
Yeah, it's all about
in
social.
The face of all this horrible humanity going yeah. on, you don't even have that.
Yeah, it's all about social responsibility and accepting the world for the way it is, and talking about social obligations and the endurance of the human spirit, and a humanist message, but not a spiritual one. And so that changes a lot. It changes so much about the story, even though all of the plot points are basically the same, except for a couple major things, I guess.
Except for the demon.
Yeah, well, the demon. Yeah. The demon and
except
the other,
anime demon.
Yeah, and the other biggest thing that every version... I've never seen a version of The Count of Monte Cristo that did not change this. Of the three adaptations that I've seen, I've never seen one that did not do this. Fernand Mondego, the guy who steals his fiance.
The bad guy.
Yeah. One of many bad guys.
The main revenge guy.
Yeah, the guy who steals Edmond's fiance. In every version I've ever seen, you know how in many versions of the Moses story they make him and Ramses like brothers or close in some way?
Yeah.
Same thing. Fernand didn't know Edmond like at all in the original novel. He was just sort of a mewling asshole who wanted his fiance. They weren't friends. In every adaptation I've ever seen, wisely, I would say they
make
them
friends. It's more dramatic.
They make them best buddies. But apart from that, everything else, and that's just a common, like, oh, of course. But apart from that and the demon, yeah, most of the plot points the same, but it is I never picked up on this as a teenager when I first watched it, but most of Monte Cristo's themes are political in nature. They are mostly concerned with the world at large, socio-political ideas. So that was interesting to me, which certainly the book is not really, because I think Dumas had a lot of a political conflict, which he pours into the book, which is like, he doesn't really want to say anything bad about Napoleon Bonaparte, and he doesn't really want to say anything bad about imperialism because his father worked for Napoleon before he got kicked out of the army for being black. I'm not kidding, that's what happened. So he has conflicted feelings on that, so he doesn't really want to endorse one thing or the other per se, he just wants to look at the time period. Gankou Itsuo has no such illusions. It is very, like, down on the aristocracy, down on war profiteering, down on imperialism, and all that stuff. Very, like, hey, this is the worst thing ever, and it should burn to the ground, you know. So, it's interesting.
Right. So, I guess, Lindsay, what was your take on this show, like, in terms of what it was about? Like, did it strike you as more than just plot? How did you feel about it?
Okay. So, as far as more than just plot, I don't, having watched like the last episode where everything accumulates together at the end, I guess what I found most surprising is I wasn't entirely sure that the Count actually, I mean, his skin color goes back, like the kiss that breaks the revenge spell. Mm-hmm. But I was kind of internally chuckling a little bit because he's laying there dying and he's telling his servant, like, no, still bring me my sword. I need to stab this kid before I die. And then, and he takes his hand. He's like, I'll live on, you know, I'll live on for you, even though you're, and he's like, no, I still need to kill you. So I'm not 100%. I guess it came off very cynical to me in that the ending, it didn't really have for the Count anyway. I don't know that he ever got, you know, he didn't have that turning point really. I mean, there was that whole, the beast became a man thing again, but I'm not sure he ever really let go of his revenge. I think he just sort of died and,
yeah,
I don't know. Maybe that's an unpopular interpretation, but I didn't really feel for sure that he opened himself up to love again in his last moments. It still kind of seemed like he was hanging on to that, even though the intergalactic demon was gone.
I think that's true, and I think that's difficult for people to parse because it's called The Count of Monte Cristo, and because every other version it's about him, and you expect some sort of turning point. But this version isn't really about him. Like, at all. He's the bad guy, you know.
The other thing is that I would say is that in this version, what they decided to do was take something that was, which anime does this a lot, you take something that's intended to be a metaphor and you just make it really literal inside the story to the point where its metaphorical use and meaning is kind of confused or made more vague. Mm-hmm. In this instance, the revenge that brewed in his mind in that cave is given literal life and evil intent and, you know, possesses him literally. Mm-hmm. It leaves his body at the end of the show, mm-hmm. but he was still revenge minded. Mm-hmm. So if the demon leaves his body and he says, now I don't want revenge anymore, it would be kind of a cheat. The demon isn't the one that wanted him to get revenge. The demon's just a metaphor for his anger and hatred.
Right.
And his murderousness. Like, the murderousness is gone. And by the way, I thought when he's saying, like, I still have to kill him, he's talking about his dad, right?
He's talking about Albert.
Is he? Okay.
His revenge? No.
Bring me my sword. I have to kill him before I take my last breath.
Yeah, that's the thing. His victims have to live. He insists that they have to
live.
He wanted to kill. Yeah, he wanted to kill his son in front of him is what he wanted to
Right. Do. Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, okay. Then in that case, in as much as you want him to say, like, I guess revenge is a dish best served cold, or whatever he's supposed to say.
Yeah, right, it's not.
It's not to be. And, like, the show is so cynical about humanity and these people that you're watching awful people cut each other, beat each other to death in a mud pit, basically, for the entire show. If he somehow were just redeemed because he wasn't being possessed by a demon anymore, I feel like the emotional stakes of the story kind of go out the window, because then it was all just a demon.
Right.
That's true. It also felt like at that point, though, there were these, you know, with the kiss and everything, there's sort of like these hints about, well, I guess there's this overarching theme sort of like, do the sins of the father pass down, right? Is Albert and all of his friends, you know, are they destined to become as awful as their really, really horrible parents that are corrupt and, you know, examples of pretty much every sin under the sun. So are they going to fall in their footsteps, or do they actually have a chance of being good people? And it kind of felt like throughout the end of the show, Albert was trying to, I don't know, that he's not his father, that, you know, maybe he was going to show the Count, I don't know, that humanity still has hope, I guess, is sort of what it seemed like they were trying to use his character for, that despite what he came from, you know, this betrayal and everything, that he could still incite hope into the Count. And then that didn't really happen. So, I don't know, I kind of, that's what I was kind of expecting a little bit, but I could also understand that, yeah, if it maybe went that way, it would be a little too cheery. And
yeah. You know, I'm kind of like, I'm kind of with you on that. And I, you know, Jacob actually had some good points on this, but I thought it was thematically pretty kind of weak, not so much weak in that, like, it just doesn't really commit to any of its messages. It doesn't really fully commit to them thematically. What it does is it kind of hints at things like, so you have these three pillars of aristocratic society. You have the military, you have the law, and you have finance, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's criticizing these three pillars. Now, in this show, they're all sort of cartoonish supervillains. Mm-hmm. And what you're watching is this carnival of the terrible behavior of humanity. You're watching man's inhumanity to man on this operatic stage. And it's deeply cynical. It's an indictment of these people and their behavior. And their behavior is sometimes extreme, like it's over the top and bizarre to the point of, like, you want that kind of fucking gut rending, horrible revenge for something petty, you know. And these characters doing it to each other under the Count's machinations, but it really is like this. Look how terrible humanity is. Deeply cynical. But then it doesn't really, like, people don't really. Like, the depths to which these characters sink, you know, it all feels really soap opery. And if you're trying to indict these pillars of aristocratic society, this feels like an editorial cartoon.
Right.
And a little
right. You have the banker who's, yeah, you know,
it feels like
sell off his own daughter.
It's a ham. Yeah. And it's a ham fisted
political
cartoon.
Naked into space among gold bars.
Yeah, yeah.
And dies there. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, okay, I get your point, but like, you didn't like, that's cartoonish, and you didn't like, it feels like you didn't really commit to this, these messages. And so that's kind of how I felt about it. Not only that, but like the Count himself, I found his motivations, and I felt like for most of the show, you are intended to find his motivations as romantic.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't. There's a moment where in episode 15 or so where Albert goes with the Count into space, and they take a journey together. And this is kind of the middle of the show where he's sort of figuring things out.
They get really high on opium.
They get really high. Yeah, they smoke. They smoke a.
Woo.
Yeah, they get fucking blazed and talk about the world. And he describes his story to Albert, and Albert says, "That's the saddest thing I've ever heard." And you're like, "Is it? Like, that sucks." Mm-hmm. And this dude should get maybe. Maybe he wants his revenge for the time he served in prison. But beyond that, like, he's pining for love lost, which I get. But when you look at this whole thing, you're like, that's fucking ridiculous. No, that's not the saddest thing I've ever heard. And it doesn't justify any of this. I guess that's kind of the point. But it started falling apart a little bit for me there because the Count seemed absurd to me then.
Well, initially, I feel like in the first half or so, he's more of an anti-hero than a villain. I mean, it's really just him, like, conveniently revealing these awful secrets about people who are doing bad things, and they're finally getting punished for it. And you're like, oh, okay, you know, the judge is getting arrested, things like that.
They're all getting their ironic comeuppance.
But I'm also going to kill all your kids. Where it's right. Okay, maybe
I also
so
need
much.
To murder all your children in front of you.
Well, yeah. That was the that's the thing with their sort of literal metaphor for the consumption of vengeance of the soul, which is that he does start out, his vengeance is, he has the same end game initially, but it becomes more and more the more Gunkutsuo takes over his soul. And, you know, you see this with the eyes popping up on his face and, you know, and his heart crystallizing, the more ridiculous his vengeance becomes, to where it is more irrational and it's more undeserving and it's more cruel, and he's becoming more like the,
yeah, the metaphors. Yeah. He, you know, the it's literally consuming him.
Right.
Like,
yeah. No,
because it has to be literal.
But the thing I wanted to say about the whole, can you really make a commentary on these institutions when you've turned them into a cartoon and the vengeance on them into a cartoon? I strongly disagree that's really what the show was about. And I think that the show, if anything, it suffers a little bit from expectations of being an adaptation of the story that originally was about these other characters. Because I don't think it's about those characters. Where it's not about the Count. It's not about his three targets of vengeance. They're important for giving the plot purpose, but its emotional core lies entirely with their children. Those are the actual main characters, and their journey and their perspective on all of this is what the show is actually trying to comment on, not the terrible, awful people that their parents are. And I think that's what the show is actually about. Having rewatched it, it jumped out to me that, like, oh, I think the entire show is kind of about the loss of an accountability for privilege.
And you're not saying that in a hot take sort of way.
Not in a hot take sort of way, but like, young kids who have never had to want for anything.
These are really French aristocrats.
They are literally French aristocrats.
Think Versailles.
And
all of the excesses and atrocities therein.
And less wigs, though.
Right, but yeah, like, so as much as we're talking about the Count and his machinations, because that's the juicy stuff, the perspective always lies with the kids, and all these early scenes, all of the early development for these characters is stuff like watching them all eat together. They're at a picnic, they're all eating together, and there's a background chatter where they're talking about the war and talking about, well, it's okay, our opponents aren't really, I don't really think of them as a sentient race anyway. And this is going on in the background of people just talking about, like, I was gonna go on the shopping trip with my fiance's mother, and we're gonna, like, gossip about him, I don't really want to be betrothed to this guy, but that's how it is, we don't marry for love anyway, and they're bitter about it, but also, like, you know, not really acknowledging the real problem with the system, all this stuff. And anyway, my point is, like, the idea is these aren't bad people, but they are basically denied actual love or friendship or the impetus to change things for the better because of their extreme privilege. Because they're so well off, and they're basically just filled with naivete and lack of responsibility about anything that's really happening in the world. They literally live in a ridiculous walled off, like, this ridiculous CG paradise of excess, of Vegas type excess, that's behind a literal wall. And when you go up to the end of the wall and you look out, you see, like, a wasteland. Because, you know, conservation has not gone so great in the year 5000. But, you know, so all of it is definitely, I think, a metaphor for the ways in which privilege has to be dismantled at a certain age, and how do you cope? And my point being that Edmond, even though he wasn't an aristocrat, he was a commoner, has this happen to him and does not survive the process. And so basically it's like, well, when you have things taken from you and you see that the world isn't fair, and, like, if you're in a place of extreme privilege, like Albert, you assume that systems work and people are good, and my mom and dad love each other unconditionally, and the law works in favor for people, and there's nothing wrong with the war, and my dad only took, like, good, he was a noble soldier, and, like, nobody really got hurt that mattered. All this stuff that he says at the beginning is taken from him. And he has this struggle of, like, am I still the same person? He says that to his best friend over and over, is like, am I going to be a different person now that I'm not noble? Am I going to be a different person now that these people are dying, that I don't have this friendship anymore, that, you know, all this stuff. And it's basically, I think that the show's ultimate purpose is to talk about, like, it's okay to lose that. It's okay and important to lose that privilege, because there are good things about it. And, well, first of all, it's just important because you have to recognize the gravity of the sacrifices that were made to give you the life that you
see the world for the way it really is.
Yeah, it's like all these horrible things were done in the past so that Albert could have a completely conflict-free life. And when that's taken from him and he's forced to address all the terrible things that happened, like, he's an innocent. He hasn't done anything wrong. It's like people saying, like, you know, I'm a good person. I'm not, like, you know, don't tell me that, like, you know, that there's high degrees of rape. I've never raped anybody, that kind of a thing, for guys, or for, you know, like, any number of things where you're in a privileged position of, like, oh, don't call me racist. I'm white, but I'm not racist. All that sort of thing. When that's taken from you, how do you react to it? Do you do the socially responsible thing? Do you grow up? Do you kind of come of age?
Take and responsibility survive? For yourself.
Yeah. Or do you
lash out?
Yeah. Or do you lash out? Or are you consumed by grief and bitterness over what has been taken from you? And so that to me was the actual theme.
There are lines in there directly about that. He says there's a line in there about what growing up is, which is like everything's taken from you. That must be what growing up is, something like that.
Yeah,
right. Mm-hmm. There's a line like that. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of thematic moments in there. There's a line where his dad, the bad guy, for lack of a better term for it, just says like. Truth is what you shape with your bare hands. Mm-hmm. The truth is what you make truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a dictator. Yeah, there are lines like that directly that are directly political and directly, commentative politically. But like I felt like by the end of the show, I wish it had all come together a little bit neater, a little bit more... tidy, but yeah, that's those nitpicking.
Well, I agree that it's mostly the primary goal of this show is to entertain you and to kind of blow your mind with the aesthetic and the way it's directed and the pacing and whatever, and to get you to feel a thing, because lots of sad things happen to good people, and then they have little triumphs and stuff like that. Like, obviously, like, its main goal is entertainment. It's just that as a teenager, watching it, I was like, is this about anything? I don't know. And it's because I didn't really have perspective for what it was about, which is mostly rooted in sociopolitical ideas. The only thing I wanted to add about, like, okay, well, you have to adopt social responsibility or whatever, but it's not all negative, because this is a love story. A lot of this is about, like, love. What does love mean to you? What is regret? What is sorrow? What is, you know, all this stuff? And this is also present in the original novel. The good thing, I guess, about losing privilege, about being forced to grow up and address the world from a place of insecurity, is that the novel, and this is controversial, of course, but it's the theme it's certainly what the show and the novel believes, is that love and friendship, like real connections with real people, kind of can't exist in a place of extreme privilege.
Right.
The Count has a line about... friendship not being able to exist in Paris, which is ridiculous on its face at first, but then what he really means by that is that love can't exist without challenge, without risk, and friendship can't exist without stakes. And when your friendship is put to the test, and when your love is put to the test, as it is for Albert, you find out who your real friends are. Like, he finds out that his more privileged friends, Lucien and Beauchamp, are kind of out for themselves for the most part. They're not, like, terrible people, but he's not really going to be close with them anymore, because when the chips, you know, are kind of on the ground, and Albert's father is accused of horrible treasonous things that he totally did, war crimes that he totally did commit, those two friends are like, they take advantage of it. They're like, okay, that's going to help me politically, this is going to help me in my journalism career, and they take advantage of it. Whereas his true friends, Eugenie, Franz, Peppo, and... the name. Oh, Maximilian, which are notably a woman, a gay guy, a trans woman, and Maximilian, and a poor person, a commoner, are the people who really stick with him. And it's like when challenges arise, like kind of losing this inability to basically gaining freedom and gaining social responsibility also allows you to forge real bonds with people and really come together in love over the protect the things that you care about. And so,
people who would die for you and who you would die for because you have a real connection.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's valuable, the idea that, like, okay, yeah, losing privilege sucks, and we would all like to have no problems and live perfectly rich with no issues, but it isn't really possible for love and in real bonding to happen if you have everything already.
Until Albert's stripped of his title, even, that he starts putting any kind of first thought and then actual effort into his relationship with Eugenie and making a commitment to his love for her. And he literally has to, you know, start sneaking into places. He starts getting into fights with guards, you know, when he wants to go see her concert and everyone's working against him to stop him from being able to go because he's no longer anybody important. You know, he makes the effort to get backstage and be there for her.
Yeah.
So he becomes a lot less. I don't think he was ever really insufferable before, but he just, he really starts to develop a, I don't know, a backbone, a personality, and figure out what's important to him.
He goes from being a little shit to being less of a little shit.
Well, yeah, and it's funny because you say he's a little shit at the beginning, but it's not like he ever does anything wrong. It's like, at heart, he's a good kid.
No, little shit is pejorative. No, it's not like, it's just like...
Well, no, but it's hard to like him because there is no, like... He has everything, and he wants more. Like, Albert's arc is, at the beginning, he's like, I want a life of adventure. I want to face the real world. And, like, he says that not really knowing what it means. What he thinks it means is, I want to go get laid and explore exotic planets and stuff like that. And, like, yeah. Sort of and taking on kind of the imperialist
stuff.
Yeah,
that's the imperial mindset.
His father, that his father has put into his head. And, you know, what he grows to kind of discover is, like, facing the real world is... bad and painful and it hurts and you might lose part of yourself, but it's or you might like find out who you actually are as a person, and that kind of makes that kind of proves that he is a good person, because before that, he was just an innocent kid living off of his parents' money and whining about things that he didn't understand. Like, he's very dumb. He's very naive. He doesn't know anything. He's literally being conned by a vampire. Like, he's being conned by this horrible vampiric monster. And he's like, but I like him because he's good to me and he gave me a watch that said we'll be friends. Like, you know, he doesn't know what real friendship is.
And there's there's a parallel, I think, there between him and this what happened with his mother. Like, mm-hmm. At one point... Albert's father like yells at Mercedes saying like, your naivety is what, you know, I've always hated that about you. Or he criticizes her for not being able to infer feelings from other people. And Albert's not actually that different. It seems like he never really catches on to Franz's feelings for him.
No.
And in the same way, and his unknowingness about the world ends up leading to all these problems. I personally hold him at least 3/4 responsible for Franz dying at all because of his the glove slap incident, for his need to stand up for his father's honor. Like,
right, his reaction to being betrayed is this old patriarchal, and I don't mean that like I'm not trying to be like,
I kind of hate that these all previously useful words to describe things
exactly.
are now obnoxious buzzwords that make people turn their brain, that make people want to stop listening to you.
Yeah, I mean...
Can I just say how irritating that is to me? Because these words used to be useful for critical vocabulary.
Yes, and I mean it in the definition of there are three villains. One is a villain of greed, one is a villain of like hypocrisy and self-absorption as his image, and the other one is a violent patriarch. The idea is like he lives by the sword and he's a violent patriarch. So somebody who, like, if you offend your honor in any way, I'm going to duel you to the death, which is Albert's response to being betrayed by the Count.
Bloodthirsty king.
Yeah, and he loses his friend who lays down his life for him to protect him. Yeah. And it's just a process of him understanding that these institutions and these things that have propped him up were built on horrible violence and sacrifice and hurting the disenfranchised. And so he kind of begins to understand that, and he takes responsibility for it, but he's also given his freedom through that as well.
My one of my favorite movies, like top two, my top two like favorite movies of all time are There Will Be Blood and Ed Wood. Mm-hmm. Ed Wood weirdly has a parallel to this. One of the reasons I love that movie so much is it is because it's about the people that you survive with, mm-hmm. the weirdos mm-hmm. that you survive with.
Right.
And when you explained to me kind of what this version of this story was doing with those characters, because I have to be honest, I didn't really pick up on that before. When you explained that, I thought, that's really nice. I like that a lot. And I think it's because it reminds me a little bit. It's the same message, sort of. The weirdos that you survive with are your real family. And I like that a lot.
And the Count absolutely has the same opportunity because he surrounds himself with and the novel gives him a happy ending. He stays with these people. Like he really forms a good strong friendship with Bertuccio and with and he falls in love with Hede in the novel.
Mm.
This does not happen to him in the anime, but it is the same thing of like, okay, you've had all this taken from you. You're in a bad way. You've had to face the fact that the world is unfair and people are cruel, and these systems are in place to hurt people, basically. And what do you do after you've been betrayed like that? And the Count's response was to buckle down and hurt them back. Use all of their horrible systems against them. And there's some oorah in that. It's satisfying to see him get his vengeance on these terrible people, but it doesn't do anything for him. As a person, he stagnates. He doesn't learn the lesson of, oh, that means that I should protect other people, that I should live on and hope for the best and try to change the world for the better, which is what Albert learns because he becomes a diplomat and stuff like that. But he just wasted his life. He had a beautiful woman fall in love with him. He had servants who would follow him to the end and sacrifice their lives for him. And he doesn't really ever give up on his vengeance quest and just sort of accept that.
Sounds like the basic message, though, is that, yeah, the world is unfair and these systems are cruel and they're designed to benefit, you know, a small number of people and punish the rest. And the world is, you know, full of terrible things and fear and sadness. But when you ultimately get betrayed by it, strength and the idea is to live, though, and to build a new life and bring as much joy and love as you can to the people that mean something to you for as long as you can.
Right.
But accept the world for the way it really is.
Yeah.
And I liked that.
Yeah.
I liked that.
And I think if we go with what Jacob said about how if the main point is the cast of children and when they do the 5-year time skip, it kind of reinforces that, you know, Eugenie gets to go to the conservatory and study piano and, who else was, I had
maybe it's
someone,
like,
everyone kind of gets to go to their next place.
Yeah, and they all get happy endings except for Franz.
Right.
He had unrequited gay feelings for the protagonist. So therefore he must die.
The world is, like, brutally unfair, and it's going to be brutally unfair to you at some point. But if you band together with the weirdos that you love, it's worth it.
Yeah.
Well, I like that a lot.
Hmm. I like that as
Peppo
well.
Peppo got to be, like, an intergalactic model.
Yeah, she became super... Well, all the surviving children, like, good things happened to them, weirdly. Like, for all the horrible pain that they go through in dismantling the bad... You know, the bad past, the future's pretty bright for all the good people.
Yeah, really, it's cyclical,
except
right?
Bronze.
All the sacrifice.
Yeah. Right. They're on the up
builds
and up.
A peaceful future, and now Albert understands that sacrifice and understands that the peace that he's standing on top of was built by sacrifice.
Right. And on a macro level, that is reflected in there is a war plot. There's a horrible empire that's threatening. Because they were trying to make it look like France at the time, which was not like an imperialist regime, it was. Napoleon Bonaparte was in exile, and there was, like, you know, people who wanted to bring him back, but he wasn't currently in power. They were sort of trying to rebuild after Napoleon. Anyway, so they reflect that in Gankutsuo by making it. It is a free republic, like aristocracy and stuff like that. It's not perfect, but they are like a free state. They're under threat by a foreign empire, but the war with them is still being continued because there are people at home, but it's like the Bonapartists at home in France, who are. Have a vested interest in keeping the war going. So the villains are war profiteers. They're not imperialists, but they could become imperialists, is the idea. It's like you are on the edge of this falling into a dictator-type state again, which it almost does when show's dictator, which is Albert's dad, almost takes over. And the show ends with, like, okay, the war ended, and now we're signing a peace treaty or whatever. But it's like, this is all cyclical. This could happen again. So it's, it didn't go from a state of, like, imperialism to peace. It went from a state of, like, everything's okay, but there's a war out in space that you're not acknowledging because you're a rich little shit and you have no problems. So it was a stasis point where it could have been terrible, and they made peace with it.
You know, it's a real thematic journey. Originally, I was like, I think this is like just plot. Now I'm like, gosh, there's a whole ocean of theme in here that you can dive around in.
Right. But there's a lot of plot. Like, we didn't go into it, but it's just a lot of twisty, tangly, like a dozen characters, betrayals.
Incest.
I was going to say.
Trying not to get too excited about the incest.
No, I was going to say affairs, and she said incest.
I'm thrilled about incest.
That made me laugh because I was like, oh, I was going to just say that there was some illicit stuff going on. But yeah, there is a character who is employed by the Count to take vengeance by sleeping with his mother and half-sister.
You know, some Oedipus level stuff.
That's terrible.
Yeah, all right. Well, do we have any final observations? I feel like we've wrapped it up pretty good here. We've got some Twitter questions to get to. Lindsay, any final thoughts?
Not that wouldn't go into a whole nother spiel. I mean, Jacob brought up earlier that I thought the LGBT themes in it are really good. I guess a question I kind of had for Jacob, because he's read the original book. I heard that Eugenie had originally a lesbian lover in the book. Is that true? I haven't read it, so I didn't know if there was any truth to that or not.
Yes, so funny thing about this adaptation, they traded a pair of lesbians for gay dudes, basically, is what they did in the anime. But yeah, originally, there was no love story between Albert and Eugenie because they weren't as important. Like, a lot of the plot points are the same, but when you shift importance, some get, you know, lost, obviously. And so because the kids aren't as important, Eugenie was, a lesbian, so she wasn't interested in Albert per se, and she ends up running away with her mate. She's her music teacher. She's like conservatory music teacher or something like that, but she also cleans her room. I don't know. But
okay.
And so, yeah, they actually catch, because this part of the story is happier in the novel, but fun tidbit. So the whole threat of rape, please rescue me, Albert storyline is not in this, because when Eugenie finds out that she has to marry Andrea Cavalcanti, her half-brother, she goes, nope, and she runs away with her maid, and Andrea tries to catch up with her. Like, he goes on some other spree or something like that, like, trying to fix this revenge plot, and he ends up, like, robbing a bank and then trying to hide in a chimney, and it just so happens to be the chimney where Eugenie and her maid were staying, and so they, like, set it on fire, and he gets caught by the cops, and it's all
like
wacky.
That sounds like stuff that happens in a serial.
Yes. And so,
happens because you got to fill some space.
No,
yeah, like
really
originally,
like that we don't get to see like Andrea's anime legs like hanging in a chimney.
Exactly, that would be hilarious, but no, it wasn't to be. But no, like Franz, the original book, Franz did not have feelings for Albert. They were just friends, and he wasn't important, and he didn't sacrifice his life for him. Like that was changed. But Eugenie was. She was a lesbian, so they just swapped which one of his best friends was gay.
Oh, so she doesn't come back and, like, get with Albert either. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just her and her female lover?
Yeah.
The end? Okay, cool.
That's it. They just run off. They're like, screw this, and they leave the story.
Yeah. The show is, like I said, the LGBT stuff is pretty backgrounded, but it's backgrounded in a way that's nice, because it's just sort of like, yep, this is just how it is.
Mm-hmm. I think Peppo, in particular...
No one's ever vilified for it, either.
No, not at all.
Does Peppo exist in the book at all in any way, shape, or form? Is there a character named Peppo?
Yeah, his name's Peppino, and he's not trans, exactly. He just cross-dresses to lure men into... He just cross-dresses in, so Luigi Vampa can kidnap guys. But he doesn't... The difference is, like, after that whole subplot ends... Peppino doesn't become like Albert's maid and watch over him and stuff like that. He just he just leaves the story. But yeah, like there is a cross-dressing bandit in Luigi Vampa's gang that is in charge of catching boys in during Mardi Gras. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I mean, so besides that backgrounded stuff and those changes that they made, I mean, thematically, I don't know that it was saying anything about LGBT stuff other than happily presenting it as just a normal facet of life.
I guess, thematically, perhaps not. It's just impressive to me because of how much anime you watch and the tropey stuff you see over and over and over again. So then to watch a show that is over 10 years old and to have a trans female character and they're just a trans female character. It's not some stubbly face, you know, with horrible makeup.
Yeah, it's not a stereotype or joke.
And
she becomes a successful
girl. They use female
pronouns,
and she's in love with a guy, and no one's freaking out or going into panic every time she enters a room. It's just really... I just think it's impressive considering the time period, and just we don't get that very often.
Yeah.
Well, the one thing I was gonna say is in terms of those themes entering the story's main theme in any way, instead of just being well, this has gay characters, is I should point out that on the discs, on the DVDs for the show, there's an interview with Maihiro Maeda. He says explicitly, "I wanted to explore gay themes in this show." So he doesn't follow up on that. They just go, like, what's it about? And he said, well, I wanted to explore ideas of love and when love can exist and what
destroys love. Well, Maeda's impressionist when it comes to writing. So this is, like, even so while it doesn't that I think you can say unequivocally, all of his stuff is like this. My frustration with his vagueness is is a Maeda thing, though. Like, so if he's saying, I want to explore gay themes, this is what you're going to get.
Exactly. And but in terms of the main thing, so we didn't really mention that Albert has a big gay crush on the Count. I mean,
no,
we did.
I mean, he does, but I do feel like the kiss at the end comes a little out of nowhere.
It's weird. Oh, it's weird, yeah. I won't deny. I don't think it's so much that it comes out of nowhere. It's just I don't understand why it banishes the demon.
No, I don't. He's really glitched him, and then he wasn't
the best anymore. No,
Bear in particular, it treads this line where it's like it's very easy to read him as queer, but it's also very easy to see it as like I don't know that what's the word that I want, that period of time where like men were just their friendships were different, and I mean that in like a.
That's true in the novel. Like, in the anime, because I saw that interview and the way Maeda talks about it, like it is explicitly he is in love with the Count, and the plus the promo art that has them.
Yeah.
Oh God. Yeah. So, but I don't think it's in terms of it factoring into the themes at all. I think that is the lost love that Albert has to like. He's going to end up with Eugenie. But that is the.
He'll be thinking about the Count while he's fucking.
Exactly. Oh God.
Oh.
But like the lost love.
What?
Between, well, that's very disrespectful to Eugenie.
I'm just telling it like it is.
It is. Yeah, you're right.
This whole thing's about ripping the artifice off of society, right?
He's like, can you just put these pointy ears on? Oh, and I got some blue paint.
I got some blue paint. Is this an Avatar? Yeah, it's an Avatar thing. Put it on.
It's my fetish. I really like the film. Anyway, but talking about losing privilege, and coming to terms with the world as it is, Albert does have to. That kiss, I think, is less for the Count and more for him. Like, he is acknowledging, I love you. Like, that's what that scene is. And so, and that's supposed to be the moment at which Albert is able to move on and says that I'm going to live on no matter what, even though I've lost everything. So I think that the theme, the intended idea, even though it's silly because it breaks the curse on the Count for some reason, even though it's silly, I think the intent was, I've come to terms with the fact that I've lost all this stuff. Also, like, I'm a little queer. Like, I was in love with you. I say that it was a friendship, and I respect you as a person, but, like, one of the reasons I was blind to being conned this whole time is because I was in love with this guy. Like, so he's, you know, he's acknowledging that, and he's letting go of it, and it's the lost love. So, yeah, that ties into the main theme a little bit.
All right, let's move on to these Twitter questions. Tuber Deformed asks, which wacky fabric pattern was your favorite? You know, they varied from sort of Baroque and patterns that I felt worked with the style to that looks like they got it off of a paper towel or a paper plate.
All right. I believe the fashion design in this, all the costume design and stuff, that was by Anna Sui. Is her name Anna Sui? She's a famous.
That's an actual fashion designer. Like, she makes handbags and stuff.
Yeah. She's a famous fashion designer. So that would explain the immense wardrobe.
Did she work on every episode? Because the early episodes look better than the later ones in terms of the design.
I just know she was.
Well, someone's also credited as, quote, collage artist, and I don't remember which name was attached to
that.
It's got to
be all the back.
Noting that someone is the collage artist. For the fabrics, I feel like Haiti got the better end of the deal, like, most of the time. Like, whatever was put on her kind of, like, robes and stuff was usually pretty good looking.
Yeah.
But
she looked good.
On the other hand, I noticed which one I really liked for it being ridiculous was in the last couple episodes. Renan shows back up, the car guy, and he's got he's wearing some kind of jacket, and it's white, and it's got just like random line art things on it. And one of the images looks like a couple. It's a man and a woman, just from the shoulders up. They have like 1980s hairdos, and they're eating a piece of watermelon together. And that's just like repeating on there, and I just thought it was hilarious.
Like random sketches on his,
I thought Franz had generally the best outfits.
Right. My favorite was the.
I guess that's a cliche. He was the best dressed.
He's well dressed. Yeah, definitely.
His coats look good.
My favorite was.
I was like, I would wear that coat.
Yeah,
in 2003.
There's some. There's
not right now, though.
My favorite was there is when Albert first goes to visit the Count, and he's like, Peppo's like, well, what you're wearing isn't really flamboyant enough to visit somebody like that. And he's like, not flamboyant enough. So he goes and he gets a literal pirate costume with a pirate coat that has the word, that has the letters like P-A-R-I-A-T-E, like interspersed on it. So it's a pirate coat that says pirate. Like, for God's sake. Yeah. That and Luigi Vampa's Cobra jacket.
Mm.
That one was cool.
Sasquatchulus wants to know if why Gonzo never made anything good as this ever again. Well, that studio's had trouble.
Mm.
What are you saying? Are you saying that, Jesus, I'm trying to think of Gonzo shovelware.
Vandred.
People like
Vandred.
That was considered like
the
good
DVDs
Gonzo.
For this, and it had a giant ad in the beginning of it for Vandred.
Mm. Yep, it would have.
No, they shoveled out a lot of
Vandred, Helsing TV,
mm-hmm.
Gonzo, Gatekeepers.
There you go.
Yeah. Last Exile.
Now, people like Last Exile.
I know. I didn't want. It's just when I say the words Last Exile, my brain thinks, my brain sees a PlayStation 1 airship.
At My Hero.
Flying through a canyon of PlayStation 1 graphics.
Yeah. My Hero Maeda did the designs in Last Exile as well.
He did.
Mm-hmm.
Did a lot of work at Gonzo. Stefan wants to know, Gankutsuo's writing is so lucid that it seems to resolve all plot points. So is there much of a story that rewatching reveals? Well, Jacob just talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
Thematically, yes. Plot-wise, I don't...
I mean, there's a lot of shit
you might wonder,
you
like,
might
which like, what happened to what characters.
Yeah, a fun little tidbit. I only actually know this from reading production materials, but if you watch the show really closely and paused a lot, you can probably figure it out. But Gankutsuo's original victim, like, when he appears to possess Edmon, his initial victim is a desiccated corpse that's holding, like, gold bars and stuff like that, and it is implied to be through, if you look closely, and it also says the production materials that's intentional, his previous victim was this world's version of the Man in the Iron Mask. So,
oh, really?
They say that once, actually, in the script.
Oh, they do?
They bring up...
It's Leonardo DiCaprio?
Because I remember I was like, why are they talking about the Man in the Iron Mask? And then I was trying to figure out, did Dumas write that? I don't remember. And so they do say that in the script once. Not
that was
just,
Hugo, right?
They refer to Gankutsuo as the Man in the Iron Mask once.
It's for funsies, but yeah. He was the Man in the Iron Mask 1,000 years ago, and now that body's dead. And,
people who star in an adaptation of one generally star in an adaptation of the other. Those are very similar. Like, you put those together on the 6th grade reading,
mm-hmm.
Probably not anymore. Right. I doubt they're asking 6th graders to read The Count of Monte Cristo.
No.
How do y'all feel? Britt asks, how do y'all feel about the decision to remove Eugenie's lesbian side plot? I guess we talked about that, where they replaced it with
they replaced it with Franz, so, whatever. It's not like it was really important in the original novel anyway. Eugenie was like a comic relief character.
You can't accuse the show, he just changed it. You can't accuse the show of whitewashing the gay out.
Yeah.
It ends with a magical gay kiss that banishes a demon.
Yay! Ugh.
That's what happens when two men kiss. Demons are banished. Did you know that?
Demons are very homophobic.
I was not aware.
Ironically. As Akari asks, how do you feel switching the POV from the Count to the novel? How do you feel switching the POV from the Count to Albert in the anime? Is that a good choice? How do you feel about it, Jacob?
It could have been disastrous, but it worked because they changed a bunch of stuff. They changed what the story was fundamentally about. If they tried to just tell the same story from the novel and make it about Albert, it would have been kind of crappy. So, they had to go in and rework everything about the story, except for the plot, obviously. But yeah.
It turns out that a prophecy foretold that Albert will be the one.
Anyway. Kill the Count.
Yeah. Turquoise Moave asks, how do you feel about the treatment of Franz with regard to LGBT representation? I thought it was great.
I love Franz. He was my favorite character. I was back when I first watched this, I was still very cloistered, living out in Kentucky, very fundy upbringing, and I was homophobic. Like, I was against gay marriage. I thought all that stuff was, like, you know, bad and wrong and stuff like that, because that's how I've been brought up. And Franz was my favorite character. I still loved him. I didn't you know, like, that's, hey, that's what that stuff is supposed to do, by the way. It's like a good representation of gay characters is supposed to, like, humanize them and make it so people don't see them as, like, this other thing that's wrong.
Paint this scary, dangerous other
thing.
Yeah,
exactly. I was like, oh, Franz is my favorite. And I knew he was gay. Like, I wasn't that ignorant. I was like, oh, well, this guy likes Albert like that. But it didn't matter to me. I thought he was just the most likable, best character. I felt for him. So, yeah, like, that was, you know, that was important.
Jeez, now, this was an important show to
now
you.
Now I'm a gay dude, so, you know, that's how it works.
Look at you now. Deacon Ice asks Jacob, have you read the other novel or seen other adaptations? What do you like best about each version? Do you want to just run down, like, the versions that you've seen and which one you think is the best one?
Yeah, the BBC did a version that was crap, and I didn't really like anything about it, so I don't have anything good to say about that one. I don't remember when that was. I think it was in the 80s that they made that. And
BBC in the 80s is going to be rough.
So I saw this. This version, I like that it is super modern, secular, its own take. We've discussed it for like an hour, so I don't need to like go further than that. The Hollywood movie version, I like that it is, the production design is really good. I think it's super well cast, and I think the script is fun and witty. It's fun and witty in sort of a theatery way, but it bears, apart from the spirit, apart from the same message, it bears very little resemblance to the novel. It's basically like the super Hollywood action hero, action adventure hero version of The Count of Monte Cristo, so it doesn't have the spiritual themes. It's like, revenge is bad, but if you get what you wanted anyway, it's fine. Yeah. Like, he has a line, so this is the one line in it that I don't like. Like, it has a bunch of witty Hollywood whatever banter in it, but at the end of the Hollywood version, he completes his revenge. This is the only version, actually, of The Count of Monte Cristo where he completes his revenge instead of backing off on it in some way. Either in the anime, like, he backs off of it because he's forced to, because he dies or whatever, and then the novel, he backs off of it out of mercy. In the Hollywood movie, he actually just kills everybody. And he's asked by Fernand at the end, like, what happened to your mercy? And I hate this line. He says, "I'm a count, not a saint." And it's stupid, but like the rest of it, I really like. It's not the novel. It's completely different, but it is a very fun, like, if you like swash swash buckle buckle type movies, which we don't get a lot of, it's good. So the acting's real good.
Trick Ballas asks, did the shifting backgrounds in the clothing make you a little nauseous, or was that just me? I've seen this complaint a lot that the visual style made people nauseous. I think it's because of the things standing still while other things are moving in weird incongruous ways. It didn't. I am prone to motion sickness, and this thing didn't get me. It didn't bother me.
Yeah, I think you get the only part that made me nauseous is like the CG, and that's just because it was awful.
Just because it looked like garbage.
Yeah. Oh, it was so bad, and I don't know why, but all of it is like gray.
Yeah, it's
everything
they don't
decided to make
things
in the like computer graphics is like this just bland gray color
because they don't want to texture it. Yeah,
yeah,
it was
my favorite.
It does not hold up at all.
My favorite is when they first show you the big CG city of Oh God, Make It Stop. The Lucien, actually, his line is actually, he gestures out with his arm because they're talking about the outside world. And he goes, "Nonsense, this is what we should be looking at." And he gestures at the big CG city. And I'm like, no, I don't think maybe we should be looking at 2004.
3D Studio Max for DOS.
Yeah.
That's what we should be looking at.
They clone stamp. Like, that's the funny thing is, like, they can only make so many non-textured CG models. So a lot of them are cloned. So there's, like, a blimp heading over the city. But if you see in the distance, like, there's the exact same blimp as over there.
Yeah.
And there's
yeah.
three copies of this one statue.
And then there's some hand-drawn, like, hot air balloons or something. And then, I don't know, then there's like a shiny spaceship, and then
there's a few,
everything's bad.
There's some nice character animation in this.
Oh, yeah. For the most part, I really like the way the show looks, largely because I like the way that it's storyboarded and directed. Like,
yeah,
it's a lot of really sharp angles and really good use of the camera and everything, but the technology has not aged well. It gets by because the story's good and because the directing is really good, but the CG is absolute trash, and the aesthetic is a little too ambitious for what it can pull off. But for the most part, it's very admirable. It's a good-looking show.
Yeah, it seems like they really wanted to, like, they kept showing the Count in his carriage with his metal horse monsters or something, and I felt like in the beginning, like, they wanted to, like, bring that out as many times as they could.
There's a series of video games called Out of This World that are old. They're referred to as Another World in some other countries, that have these sort of pixelated blob monsters, and the people in the listening who know what I'm talking about is very similar. These horrible-looking horses, except it was they looked okay in those video games, and here is it looks so bad. I like this question from Red Car. Anime count rages until death, while novel count becomes remorseful and seeks balance between justice and mercy. Which character is more human? I have some bad news for you. Those are both incredibly human things,
right?
And they are both one of those is what you hope happens. The other one is maybe more likely.
Right. If you're asking me which character is more complex and developed, the novel, definitely. But he's the focal character. He's not the focal character in this. So, you know. Albert is more complex in the anime, so there you go.
Yeah.
Yellow Redfield asks, compared to the book, did you feel the supernatural aspect introduced in the anime reduced the Count's free will and responsibility? So we talked about this, too, where if at the end he'd said, what came over me? It was all a dream. Anyway, here I am, back from the dead. Like, that would have completely abdicated him of responsibility for any of it, because it would have just been the demon's fault. Mm-hmm. So it had to end the way it did.
Yeah, he's fully aware of what's happening the entire time. And I wonder, like, the whole kiss to banish the demon thing, like, I don't... The only way that that would make any sense, because they were like, we can't let it go of Gunkutsuo unless he regains his emotion, unless he backs down on the pact. So, in that moment, did he do that because he got a kiss? Is that what happened? I don't understand.
I don't know.
They also kind of imply that, like, the medication he's taking was preventing that. So, like, did they have, like, magic love pills, and that's what he was taking to kind of, like, keep it at bay or something? Or was that just supposed
the medication
to, like,
was just for...
fix the crystallization thing that was going on with his heart? I don't really know either.
Yeah, the medication was just to keep his body alive, because if his body dies, Gunkutsuo could still use it, obviously, but it's, you know, like, he can't keep control of his body if he's a zombie, so that's basically what that's there for. But all of this stuff was perhaps could have been explained a bit better, because I do not know why the kiss of love. I understand thematically why it banished the demon, but it seems like I needed a little more details for it to not be like, what, you know.
Christopher asks, do you believe the show kind of ruined the Count as a character by skimming over his imprisonment and making him a straight up bad guy? Well, they didn't skim over his imprisonment. They go into full detail. Mm-hmm. I feel like the Count's complicated enough. I don't think that he's a bad guy if you don't empathize at all with his motivation. Mm-hmm. If you can empathize with his motivation at least a little bit, mm-hmm. he's not irredeemable. Yeah. He's doing something that is recognizably human, and mm-hmm. if that had happened to you, you can't say you wouldn't do it.
Yeah, and
right.
And so,
the beginning of the series kind of... we said it earlier, but beginning of it, I disagree that he's kind of presented as a villain. All he's doing is bringing to light, like, all the shitty things
he starts literally cackling evilly.
Literally laughing evilly.
Which they... Like, mm-hmm. like, and you're like, okay, he's a bad guy.
Yeah, well, there's literally a transition between, like, he kind of sheds his last tears for Albert right before he starts cackling evilly, because his plot... Basically, this is Albert's last moment before his dad's going to be stripped of his title and put on trial for war crimes, and everything bad in the world is going to happen to him. And in that moment, like, the Count cries for him. Like, he mourns that this bad thing has happened to this innocent kid that he's come to care for. But 2 seconds later, you know, the rush of euphoria of, yes, finally, after, like, 20 years or whatever, takes over, and he starts laughing evilly. So there is both of those in him, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Megabatimus wants to know if Gunkutsuo had been more success. I mean, I can't characterize the success of this show either in Japan or here. I don't have sales figures for it.
I know the sales in Japan. I have no idea over here.
How did it do there?
Fine, like 3K.
This is would it have led to more classic novel adaptations? I don't know. Maybe. There's plenty of anime classic novel adaptations.
Yeah, I was going to say that's not really unusual. Usually they're children's shows.
I would like to see stuff like that. I actually would be, like, if there was a new rash of literary adaptations, I'd be fine with that.
Yeah.
I feel like those stories don't get adapted that much anymore, largely because most people assume they're not going to make money. Uh-huh. But, I don't know.
They're not in vogue right now, so.
Okay, let's see here. A Tasty Sub asks, any other novels from the 1800s you'd like to see get an anime?
I mean, they did make one for Les Mis, right? Les Mis is my other... Count of Monte Cristo and Les Mis are my two favorite, like, stories from that time period. I think there's one kind of for Les Mis. I just never watched it because it's old. But if you made, like, a like a crazy Gankutsuo style version of Les Miserables. Like, yeah, I'd
That'd watch be awesome.
Yeah.
I would love
it. Okay, maybe this is a question. I saw that on Twitter earlier and gave it some thought. And I don't know if it'd have to be Gankutsuo style, but I'd love to see some of the classic horror films, or not horror, sorry, horror novels, like A Turning of the Screw, something like that, yeah. Done in an anime could be really good. But that's a genre that I always feel gets so neglected from everything that we get that comes out, or anything mystery related that tends to come out nowadays is not very good. Mm-hmm. And so I'd like to see like a really good creepy anime adaptation of the horror novels from that time period.
Hmm. Yeah.
That could be maybe cool. Not like Dracula, that's been done like a gazillion million times, but
no, yeah. Let's get another Dracula adaptation.
He's literally, I believe Dracula is the most...
Oh my god, he drinks blood!
I believe Dracula is the most adapted character in history.
What's that werewolf doing? All right. Mary Klausmus wants to know, which is the better title order? Gankutsuo, The Count of Monte Cristo, or The Count of Monte Cristo, Gankutsuo?
The former, I think. Right?
Yeah.
Right. I don't know, I like the latter.
We shall have war. Space war, even.
It should be called Revenge. Only if you win. all right. I think that is our last question. All right. I think that wraps it up. Well, guys, it was a very productive discussion.
Yes.
Thanks, Lindsay. Thanks for dropping by.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Lindsay for stopping by. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes, leave us a rating, a review. We'd really appreciate it. I'll see you all next week.